You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. If the local drug dealer knocks on your door for a cup of sugar for your meth lab, relax. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast at any time by going to 3cr.org.au, Radical Australian. Hey presto, there it is. Daryl, how's the podcasting going?
Oh, slowly but surely, Joe.
Yeah. I heard the last guest was a little bit anxious about getting her podcast up.
Oh, yeah, but I looked after it.
You looked after it. Thanks, yeah, Daryl. Yeah, all I need is complaints. The thing is, if you've got complaints about the program, you ring 3CR and you ask for Daryl. Okay, you don't ask for me.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm here to help, mate. You know that.
Well, now, I am the producer, I guess.
You deal with the complaints.
Yeah, I get all the complaints.
Yeah, but if you can't deal with them, then management contacts me and I have to deal with them, and I'm not happy about that. You know that, Daryl.
And then I'll, pass them back on to management again?
don't go that down that
circle
road.
Of fifths, you know.
Yeah. Look, we've got two extraordinary guests today. Now, I could lie and say they've come all the way from the Netherlands to talk to us, or I could tell you the truth, that they've come here for a very special reason. Now, I'm going to stuff this up. I'm going to try. Our special guests are Andy van Binsbergen.
Good enough.
Try. How should we say it?
Andy van Binsbergen.
Binsbergen. I like that. And we've got Sampari Koroa.
Almost there. Sampari Koroa.
Koroa. Yeah. And we've got security here for both these guests. Brigitte. Is that correct, Brigitte?
That's totally correct.
Thank you, Brigitte. Look, if any of them get out of control, just take them out of the studio and shoot them, will you? Now, this is extraordinary because I met Andy on Sunday for the first time at the West Papuan gathering. Now, Andy, what were you doing there on Sunday?
Long story or the short story?
Give us the short story.
The short story. Okay. I was presenting a book that I've been working on together with Eddie Koroa, which would be Sampari's father. We've been working to put together his life story as a young man of resistance, a stowaway, and it ends when he's already a grandfather.
Right, sounds interesting. But why? Why come to Melbourne?
Because the Dutch version of the book was translated into English and then picked up by Louise Byrne.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to make an English version of the book. And
right.
Here we are.
Okay, that's the short version.
Now,
Sampari, why are you here?
I'm here to support Andy van Binsbergen with the book, and of course to represent my father,
right?
The book and my family.
Right. Tell us about your father.
My father, wow. Where do I start? My father was a very, very sweet but strict person, man. Very serious about his manners and giving that through his children. And to the community, he was very active. So, yeah, I'm very proud son.
So where did he come from?
He comes from West Papua, the island called Biak, in the village of Ababiaidi.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he's from.
So how does a young man from Biak find himself in the Netherlands?
Well, yeah. That's a complicated story, I think.
Complicated? Didn't he just catch a plane in the early 60s?
No, you actually have to read the book, but it's he fled on a boat as a stowaway.
A stowaway?
Yeah.
What year was this?
This was in 64.
And how old do you think he was?
Back then he was 24.
24.
Yeah.
And why did he stow away on a boat from West Papua in 64?
He wanted to flee to the Netherlands because he didn't want to stay in West Papua because it would become part of Indonesia.
Right. Why the Netherlands? What's West Papua got to do with the Netherlands?
West Papua was a former Dutch colony.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew there were other Papuans in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess probably that's the reason why he was.
So he's basically a political refugee, actually, and he was going back to the country that colonised West Papua initially.
Yes.
Now, Indy, now I understand you've got some strong opinions about the reason that West Papua was handed over to the Indonesian military dictatorship by the Dutch.
Oh, there are many reasons, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it didn't suit countries like the US that the Netherlands would keep their hands on West Papua. Indonesia wanted West Papua. They wanted to complete from Sabang until Merauke, so from Aceh until the end of Papua. And if the US was not going to support Indonesia to get that, then there was a big chance that Indonesia would move to the communist countries. Because it was Sukarno who was in charge. He could go either way. So it was obvious that the Netherlands were pretty much on their own. And then, of course, there was our then Queen Juliana, who was married to Prince Bernhard.
Prince who?
Prince Bernhard.
Bernhard.
Yeah, Bernhard.
Is he still with us, the young prince, or is he gone to God?
Oh, he's gone.
Oh, he's gone to
long
God.
Gone. Oh. Long gone. Yeah, well, long gone.
Well,
what's
the prince got to do with all this?
Dutch people crying when he died.
What? Did he? Yeah. What's the prince got to do with it? He's not
nothing.
The queen.
He had nothing to do with it.
Why mention him?
But he was a prosperous businessman.
Ah, a prosperous businessman.
Yes. There's been some scandals.
Uh-huh.
One of the best hidden scandals is that he actually sold off West Papua to the US.
Excuse me? He sold off?
Yes.
What, he got some money for it?
No, he secured business deals.
What, to the gold mines?
Indonesian business deals. Dutch deals with Indonesia.
Uh-huh.
That would be very lucrative to the US as well.
Uh-huh.
He was protecting the business deals.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And over the back of the
Papuans. He's only the prince consort. He's not the bloody
He was
queen.
Nobody. He was
he's nobody. How did he get away with this? What happened?
Well, that's the role he took.
What?
That's the role he took, and that's...
Well, he told his wife, the queen, to be a housewife.
No, the queen didn't say anything. She just let it happen.
Mm.
There's a lot of people that actually loved the queen.
Right.
A lot of Indonesian people also remember her as a good queen, because she was a warm person.
Mm-hmm.
But can I say it? Yeah, we're not... They're not listening in the Netherlands, are they?
Well, I could, because it's his podcast.
Yeah, well, let them listen. He was a plain bastard.
Right, yeah. What did you think about that analysis, Sampari?
That sums it up quite well.
Sums it up
well.
Absolutely. So, your mum, is she still with us?
Yes.
What's her name?
Francina.
Francina.
Yeah.
And is she from West Papua?
Yes, she is.
Right. And your dad, I understand, died about a year ago, did he?
That's correct. Right. October last year. Yeah.
Right. Was it sudden or a long?
It was not really sudden. He had dementia, I guess.
Right.
So it was quite a short journey.
Short journey.
Yeah.
Have you got any brothers and sisters?
Actually, I'm the middle one of seven children.
Seven children.
Yeah.
So what was it like to grow up in the Netherlands, the former colonial masters, as West Papuans? You and your brothers and sisters and your parents.
I can say I got a very fun, good upbringing.
Right. Were you accepted?
Yes. Yeah. We grew up between all Dutch friends, neighbors,
right,
etc. In a Dutch environment.
Right.
And actually, a quiet, nice upbringing.
Right.
Youth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what type of work did your dad do?
My father worked for the Ministry of Defense as a security officer.
Right, right. And your mum, obviously looking after seven kids is full-time work, but...
Yeah, she did that till my younger brother was about 4 or 5 years old, and then she worked at the postal worker.
As a postal worker,
I guess.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of people don't understand that English is neither of your first languages, and if I had to speak a word of Dutch... I can't even pronounce your surnames. So, you know, I think you're doing exceptionally well.
How come
your English is so bloody good?
Watching a lot of BBC.
Watching BBC?
Yeah, cartoons.
Cartoons.
We didn't have YouTube yet, and internet when I was growing up, so we had to do it with the telly.
How about you, Indy?
Well, as Since nobody speaks Dutch, we have to.
What do you mean nobody speaks Dutch?
Only we speak Dutch.
All right.
And part of South Africa speaks Dutch for a reason. But if we want to cross a border, right, we have to speak a second language because nobody will understand us.
So were you born in Holland?
In the Netherlands.
In the can you explain?
He's like somebody lives in Rotterdam.
Rotterdam,
which is in Holland.
In Holland, right?
And I was born in Arnhem.
Arnhem.
Yeah.
Not Arnhem Land.
Arnhem.
Right.
And which is Gelderland, which is a different province.
Right. So what's the difference between being from Holland and being from the Netherlands?
Holland is part of the Netherlands.
So
it's
you're,
just, it's a province.
It's a province.
Yeah. So it's what? Two provinces, North Holland, South Holland.
Right.
So why does the whole world know Holland and not the rest of the country?
Yeah, yeah.
It was the Holland people that were sailing the world. Because that's the coastal area.
They were the ones who were colonizing Indonesia.
Exactly.
Papua, South Africa, you name it, they went there before the British.
Yeah, and the rest of the country were the farmers.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were the what we call the grunts, the hard workers.
Whatever you want to call
it. Yeah, and they were the intellectuals, the entrepreneurs, the exploiters, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what was it like going to school when you were a young person?
For me?
Yes, of course, you.
Yes, of course. Kindergarten and primary school, I loved school. I really loved school. Then when I went to high school, I hated school.
Right.
I just simply hated it. I remember my grandma telling me that I would look back on high school as the best time of my life.
Right.
But I'm sorry, she wasn't right.
I hope she's not with
I
us anymore.
I still hate my high school time. Yeah.
Any particular reason?
It was a horrible school.
Horrible school. Right.
It was a horrible school. But kindergarten and primary school, I really, really loved going to school. Mm. I loved it. I would skip to school.
So obviously, were you a high school dropout? You didn't finish high school.
Of course I skipped it. I'm sorry. I finished it. I was going to say.
You finished it.
I finished it. But it was two classes I had to do twice. Yeah. So I took my time, but
right.
I finished it.
And what did you do after that?
After that, I went to... how do you call that in English?
Oh, just
it's not university, academy.
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 Right.
To become a social worker.
A social worker?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
How long did you remain a social worker for?
I'm still a social worker.
All your life you've been a social worker?
Yeah, even if you're not being paid for it. I mean, once you've become a social worker, you are a social worker.
Right, right. So, and did that lead you to any interesting experiences in the Netherlands?
As a social worker, you mean?
Well, or as a human being and a social worker, yeah. Well, you would have met Sampari's family that way, did you? Or?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I met Sampari when we still called him Andy.
Andy?
Yeah.
Well, it's too many British cartoons, mate.
No, it's his second name.
Andy?
Yes. His second name is Andy.
Why did your parents call you Andy?
True story. My father loved this Indo rock band, the Tielman Brothers, and the leading singer was Andy Tielman.
All right.
That's from my father's side. And my mother loved the American crooner Andy Williams.
Right. So you're a hybrid. It's an American British hybrid.
Sort of.
Well, hopefully that didn't mean you started doing music as you got older, did it?
No.
No.
No. My own culture.
Your own culture.
Led me to sing, yeah.
What do you mean your own culture led you to sing?
I mean,
how many West Papuans were there in the Netherlands or Holland at that time?
At that time, maybe less than now, of course, but I think about around 2000.
2000?
Well, you lived right in the middle of quite a concentration of Papuans.
Yeah. Right.
It was quite a large Papuan community, active community.
Active community.
That's right. Well, in numbers, I think, about around 2,000.
Right. Well, we've got Bridget for that.
Bridget, what do you think? Come and speak on the microphone. We can't hear you there. Stop being security and bring your chair up and speak in the microphone.
Kaka Jacob, he told me that the current numbers are about 10,000, but we know about 2,000 to 3,000 Papuan people.
Right.
Personally.
Yeah. And what other colonial victims have made their way to the Netherlands? Because there'd be Moluccans, wouldn't there? Who else would there be? South Africans.
Moluccans. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they were promised, weren't they? They were promised independence by the Dutch government.
As were the Papuans,
right? I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
They were both promised independence.
The Moluccans, most of the Moluccans that live in the Netherlands are, because the first generation has almost all gone now.
Mm-hmm.
So the Moluccans that we have in the Netherlands now are all descendants of former Dutch soldiers during the Dutch colonial time. And then when the Dutch were kicked out, Dutch people like to say when we gave Indonesia their independence, which we never, we were kicked out, face it.
Okay.
So when we were kicked out, the UN forced the Netherlands to save those people that actually worked for the Dutch. So that meant that a lot of Moluccan soldiers were given the choice. You either now join the Indonesian army or you join the you join us to the Netherlands.
Right.
So those who ended up in the Netherlands thought that they had a military career.
Right.
And they also thought they would be back in about 4 months while the Dutch would settle the problem. So as soon as they arrived in the Netherlands, they were all sacked. All of them fired. So no career, just fired. So they were jobless, stateless, homeless. They were placed in camps. They still thought they were going to be back in Maluku within months, and they're still waiting.
Right. I remember the 70s. I'm old enough to remember the mid-70s when the Moluccans hijacked a number of trains to highlight the plight they were in because they'd been forgotten.
Yes.
What
Very dramatic.
What happened to those individuals? Are they still in jail? They've been
Released? Died. They were killed.
They were killed, yeah. How many were there involved?
Was it six, seven?
Six. And they were killed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just got a faint recollection that they hijacked the train to highlight.
Yeah, the two people who died on that train, one was a Dutchman and one was a Moluccan man, and they were both from my village.
Both from your village?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I do recall vividly.
Vividly. Now, Sampari. So the West Papuan presence in the Netherlands, I should say Holland, wasn't as large as the Moluccan presence?
No.
No. And the people that you were with from West Papua, were they relatives or just other West Papuans?
We consider ourselves relatives.
You consider yourself relatives. So yes. You don't have to be my son to be my relative.
Exactly.
Like right. Could you explain that to me?
The village where I'm from is in the center of Holland, of the Netherlands, in a province called Utrecht.
Yeah.
Place is called Nieuwegein. When I was born, there were about five or maybe six families.
Right.
And we all grew up together as one big family.
Right.
Although we didn't share any blood.
Right.
No bloodline, but we consider ourselves as family. So
that's
the way I grew up.
That's how you grew up.
Yeah.
And did you speak your own language as well as Dutch, or was it mainly Dutch?
It was mainly Dutch because our parents intentionally didn't teach us our language. Actually, they spoke Indonesian Malay, and they thought we were in the Netherlands, so speak Dutch.
Yeah, it was the same with my parents. It was a common immigration story in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Yeah.
And if they had grown up stuff to talk about, they could do it in.
Right.
In our language, because the children couldn't speak their language.
Right.
It was their secret language.
Yeah.
Secret language. So did you have gatherings of the West Papuan community you lived in, where you shared food and music? As you said, you took up cultural activities later on as you grew older.
Yes, we did actually. Every week on Saturdays we have our gatherings. Shared meals.
Right.
Music,
right.
Culture, art.
Right. And how was your education like?
Well, I didn't finish my high school.
You didn't finish high school. Any particular reason?
I liked the building.
You liked the building?
Yeah.
So we've got two high school rebels have come together. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
No, not that, because she actually finished her school.
But you had to repeat some subjects. She was a rebel. All right. She was a rebel. We know that. I mean, yeah. I could tell you stories about Indy, which I will later on, about her squatting days, but we won't go into that now. So you didn't finish school. So what did you do after that?
I started working from the age of 19.
Doing what?
I would just say I worked at an office, service desks.
Right.
That kind of job until now, actually.
You've been working in an office all these years. How old are you now?
You don't ask a gentleman.
Yes, you do. No, hang on. I'm gonna tell you something. You're not a gentleman. You know why? The original definition of a lady and gentleman are people who don't have to work to live and prosper. They live off other people's wages and rent. So you're not a gentleman, you're a worker.
All right. Fair enough.
So I'm asking you as a worker, how old are you?
I'm 46.
40? Oh, you're a young man.
Yeah.
Thank you. You could be my son quite easily. Yeah.
I could, yeah.
Yeah, we look the same. We've both got beards. So the same job for all those years?
The same kind of job. Right. Not the same boss, but the same kind of working field. I used to work 21 years as a service desk guy. Yeah. And the last 8 years, I'm doing back office work.
Right. So you no longer have to deal with the public if you're
exactly.
doing...
Yeah, no more phone calls.
People complaining.
Exactly.
Right. So when did you... look, I understand little birdie told me that you're a bit of a musician. When did all that start happening?
Well, yeah. When did it start? It started when I was young, in my teenage years, with the Papuan traditional music.
Right.
Started playing, started learning to play the guitar.
Right.
Because we can all sing.
We can all sing. I can't sing. Daryl.
Everyone can sing.
Daryl can't sing. Can you, Daryl? You can't sing.
No, I couldn't sing to save me life.
He used to be a professional musician, you know. He was a drummer for a number of bands. Yeah, look at him now. Look at him. He's just an old age pensioner like the rest of us. Sorry, Daryl. We've got to tell people the truth.
Oh, yeah, that's all right, Joe.
Yeah, even played in symphony orchestras. He was so good.
Wow.
Yeah. Brothers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what happened after your little West Papuan joint? Did you get into...
I still play in a music band.
What's it called?
Oceanics.
Right, and that's in Holland, is it? Central Holland, I should say, not the Netherlands.
It's in the Netherlands, yeah.
Right, and what do you play?
I'm one of the four singers.
Right, four singers? How many in the band?
Nine.
How can you get paid with nine members?
We don't do it for the money.
You do it for the laugh.
For sharing the culture.
Sharing the culture.
Yeah.
All right. And where do you play?
All over the Netherlands.
Right.
From small stages to bigger
right.
venues.
Right.
Festivals. Mainly cultural festivals.
Right. Now, I understand that if people want to get across your music, do you have any... existence on the web, any Facebook page, net page, anything like that they could look at?
Yeah, they could look it up on Instagram, Spotify.
What do they look for?
Look for Oceanics with a KZ.
Now, could you spell it for us from the beginning?
OceanikZ or Z?
Z, yeah.
And at Melanesia.
Right. At Melanesia.
Edit just
Melanesia.
Melanesia.
Yeah.
And you could find us on Instagram, on Spotify,
right.
YouTube. Yeah.
Excellent. Looks like it's a real professional gig outfit.
We're doing our best.
You're doing more than your best. More than your best. If you go on all those platforms, as they say, I've got to learn the new jingo, platforms. So, have you played outside of Central Holland and the Netherlands?
Yeah, like I said, the main big venues in Holland we've played.
How about outside Holland? Have you played outside?
Not yet,
but you're looking for a gig.
It's a big wish of the whole band.
Right. What did your dad think of you doing this?
I think he would be proud.
That's good. How about mum?
Mum, I know she's proud.
And how about your brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I guess they'll probably. I've never asked.
You never asked.
No.
Well, they came to see you at the Passer in Rotterdam.
Yes.
Yeah, I must be proud. Yeah. All right. Well, I encourage our listeners, if the more intelligent of our listeners who know about the net, to have a look.
Please.
Yeah. Oh, no, they should. They should have a look. You know, you've made the effort to come to Australia, you know, to launch this book, and we should make the effort to ensure that people know exactly what you do, not just the fact that you've been involved in the creation of a book to honour your father.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, Andy, you said, how did this all start? The book. What's the book called?
The Stowaway from Sorong to Rotterdam.
So, The Stowaway from Sorong to Rotterdam. How did all this start?
Oh, how did it start? Well, I used to share my house with Sampari's younger brother, Geoffrey. He pretty much tricked me into it.
He tricked you?
He tricked me into it. Yeah, well, no, not really tricked me into it, but he pushed it. He's the one who pushed it.
Right.
And it all started with Eddie, so Dad.
Right.
Had so many important documents. He had a fantastic archive. And he was always carrying it around or keeping it in the shoebox.
Mm-hmm.
So stage one was, we need to scan all this material in case something happens with it. So because it shouldn't get lost. So we need to scan it, name it, describe it. Well, that's been a topic for about 2 years until we finally sat together and convinced Eddie to come over with all his stuff. And I thought we're going to scan a whole bunch of pictures, but at the end of the day, we had 3 pictures scanned.
Right.
And all the stories that belong to those 3 pictures.
And can I ask a question?
Yes.
How many pictures do you think were in the box?
120.
120. So
in the box?
Yeah.
Oh, thousands.
Thousands. And you spent 1 day doing 3 pictures?
Yeah, that's when I figured that we cannot just scan the pictures.
Right.
These pictures, this box full of pictures and documents is more than a website. This is so much more. This is, if this one picture makes you talk for hours, and every picture I pick up makes you talk for hours, you got so many stories, we should make a book.
Right.
So not just write down your story, but make it a book.
And what did Eddie think about this?
Oh, he loved it.
Loved the idea.
Yeah, let's write a book.
Let's write a book.
Yeah, we didn't know it was going to take 6 years.
It took 6 years. Yes. All right, well, there were thousands of photographs. How did you decide? How many photographs are in the book?
120 in the original Dutch version. 60 in the English.
But 120. So how did you choose those 120 out of the thousands you looked at?
How did we choose? By the time we figured out how we want to form the book and how we want to put it together, it would be Eddie talking and talking and talking, me writing it down, and then I would say, do we have a picture with this?
Right, right.
And then he would go through the box and he goes, here's a picture.
Here's a picture, right, right. And what was that 6 years like for you?
That was one big adventure.
An adventure?
It was an adventure.
Right.
Yeah, and it was also, it was almost like back in school.
Right.
Because I've learned so many new things. I mean, I've had Papuan friends actually from the moment I moved from Arnhem to Utrecht.
Mm-hmm.
But I never realized that when you start dealing with first generation Papuans, traditional storytellers, you don't get the story the way we Westerners tell a story.
Excuse me, you're saying there's no beginning, middle and end?
It is. No, you get right. You get exactly. It is like a box full of beats.
Right.
And beautiful beats.
Mm-hmm.
But for us Westerners, it has to become one string to understand the story. So while we were working, because we had so many frustrations and fights and everything, but we both wanted to continue. But Eddie would, for example, start telling a story that starts in Utrecht City, or Rotterdam City or wherever, and all of a sudden he's talking about relaxing under a palm tree. Well, let me assure you, we don't have palm trees in the Netherlands.
You're kidding. Even with the climate emergency, you don't have palm trees.
Well,
you see any palm trees?
Not yet.
We don't have them.
No?
Oh. And I was like, where did that palm tree come from? And he goes, well, this was Vanuatu. And I go, okay, how did we end up in Vanuatu? Right. And he says, because of the football team. And I go, which football team?
Which football team? You've got me interested.
Exactly. Let's go back. Yeah. Let's go back. Where did this start?
Yeah.
So once I figured out that it does make sense, just not my sense.
Right.
I suggested let's make the chapters. Let's just name the chapters. Like 12 chapters, 12 stages in your life.
Do you remember the headings of the chapters? Well, some of them.
Anyway. The English version,
yeah.
Right? I remember chapter 1, when life was still good.
Mm-hmm, yep.
No, chapter 2, when things went wrong.
Yep.
Chapter 3, Exodus.
Yeah, so we just went on and on that way. You're actually able to contain the story in a format that Westerners could actually comprehend.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. And so when we would sit together, I would open like 7 or 8 of these chapters all at the same time on my laptop. And they would start telling, and I would say, where are we? Is this before or after you got married?
Right.
To figure out if this goes to which chapter.
Mm.
And I'm like, yep, keep talking. And I could just put it in the right chapter. Never mind the order. Right. Never mind, because we can do that later. Right. Just make sure it all goes in the right chapter so I know what he's talking about.
Mm.
So it took a while. It took a couple of years, but it worked.
All right. We'll talk about that in a second. Now, Sampare. It's interesting, children and parents, especially from that period, and I consider myself to be from that period, you know, your dad's time, although I think he'd have been a bit younger than I am. So during that period, would he talk to you about West Papua, about being a stowaway, or is it just something he kept to himself, these stories?
He actually told us the story more than once.
Mm.
So we did know the story, but not the whole story with the details.
Right.
He would talk about fragments.
You know, you got to make a living. You got 7 kids. You got to look after. You got to go to work.
Yeah.
Then you got to argue with your wife. Just goes on and on life, and it can be very difficult sometimes to, because a lot of children don't even think their parents actually. I've got a life, you know. They're parents, like you said. He was a strict man, right? You know, that's how you remembered him.
Yeah. Strict but fair. Yeah.
Strict but fair, but he was strict. You know, that's how you remembered him as a parent. I mean,
absolutely.
It's not like today where people say to their kids, parents say to their kids, "I just want to be your friend."
No.
Social work, Andy. What do you think of that? I just want to be your friend. No,
doesn't work.
It's not our generation now.
It doesn't work. You got kids?
Yeah, I got 2 sons.
You want to be their friends, or you're a strict parent?
I want to be a strict parent, but I think I'm more of a friend.
How old are they?
My oldest son is 22, and my youngest is 16.
Well, you can't really be strict at that age,
yeah,
mate,
I know,
because they're big enough to punch you in the face.
Yeah,
that's the reality, isn't it? They're adults.
adults. Yeah, that's true. It's true.
Yeah,
but sometimes.
Yeah. You would?
No.
I'm sure you wouldn't. Now, Indy, have you got any children?
No.
Can you tell us about your squatter days? Because I had a little bird tell me you're quite a famous squatter. Can you tell me about where you were squatting?
Famous or infamous?
Infamous, we say. I was just being facetious. We're all infamous in this studio, including Daryl and Brigitte. We're all infamous. If we were famous, we wouldn't be here.
I've been a spokesperson of the Utrecht Squatters Movement for like 20 years.
That is a worldwide recognized movement. Tell us about it.
Well, tell us about it. Our group, our clan, we were based in a building called ACU, And the police took a long time and many shots. What on earth are these letters standing for? But to be honest, it was Automobile Centrale Utrecht. Right. It was an old car garage.
Right.
Fair enough. Never changed the letters because they were quite good. Right. So yeah. Keep the letters.
Typical squatters. You don't change anything if it's useful.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's useful. Just leave it there. Yeah. It was before, actually it's bought now. We bought it.
Right.
Before we bought it, it was the longest squatted building in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. How many years?
25 years.
25. And did you have to defend the building?
Oh, many times, but not against the owner, because he was a nutcase.
Right, but I'm saying, well, against the
authorities. We were lucky. It's not that we like very tough or anything. We were quite lucky.
You're quite lucky.
I think the squatters in Amsterdam had a tougher life than we had.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah.
And I remember one day we decided to squat the empty land right next to our building. And we made a fantastic plan. We asked permission to have a festival there on the Queen's birthday. That's when permissions come very easy.
Right.
And then we wanted to put a fence there. We wanted permission for the fence.
Right.
Because we need to protect the equipment for the festival, and we got a permission for that. And after that, we gave information to the city council that we were not planning to take the fence down because we squatted
the land.
The land. And they said, what do you mean you squatted the land? Like, well, we squatted the land. Well, you did, right? What do you mean we did? So as far as the city council was concerned, they thought that the land was already ours.
Oh, right.
We already squatted that. Right. We're like, you mean it's been an illegal car park for the last 25 years?
And we didn't even make any money out of it?
We didn't even know it was ours.
Right.
Ours to use, not to keep, but ours to use. Yeah.
So you still got the land and the building?
Yeah.
And how?
Well, we have not the land anymore. We have the building, the main building.
Right.
When the owner passed away and his son took over, he wanted to sell off the whole property.
Right.
What I need to tell you, it was not just a squatted building with people living in. It was the main cultural center, multicultural as well.
Right.
So that's how we got in touch with the Papuans and the Timorese and many other groups. So it was a house, there was 12 people living upstairs and the rest was cultural, huge cultural center for all kinds, from punk to, you know. So when we found out there was a buyer for the whole complex, we thought this man is in trouble. Because even if we would be prepared to leave that building, there was like 500 people using the building.
Right.
Plus all those squatters from the rest of the country that would not accept the oldest squatted building to be evicted.
Yep.
And then there's the squatters from Belgium and Germany. This is going to be like one major riot.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to probably be written in the history books. And then we lost the building. That is not what we want.
Right.
It was our living room.
Right.
We had to keep the building.
Mm.
So we decided to visit the new owner.
Oh, right, visit him. How many of you were there?
Five.
Oh, that's all right. That's a delegation. It's not.
Two of us, very well dressed.
Right.
We actually went to the hairdresser.
Right.
And some of us looking quite radical, including myself.
Right.
And then the two well dressed were the speakers.
Speakers, yeah.
Like on behalf of
this rebel. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were accepted to come in, and actually we figured out while we were talking to this guy that he had no idea what he bought. Actually, the owner said there's 12 people living there, which is true.
Yes,
but there's like 500 people who visited every day.
And did he tell him they're not paying any rent?
Yeah, he knew it was squatted.
Oh, right.
He knew he bought a squatted building.
Oh, right, with 12
But he
people.
Thought he was dealing with 12 squatters. He said, I'll buy them out.
Yeah.
Or I find a new place for them to live.
Uh-huh.
And so actually our little threat turned into we need to warn you, sir.
Right.
You just bought yourself a huge problem.
Yes.
And he said, so how are we going to solve this? Like, well, we're not here to solve your problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, part of the complex was a building that was an official monument, so he couldn't do anything with that.
Right.
never had any interest in that building, but he wanted the empty land. Like I said, cut a very long story, very short. Mm. We bought the main building and the monument, the monumental building that he couldn't use in exchange for the land.
For the land. Well, so you didn't actually pay any money?
Oh, we paid for the land under the building.
The land under the building. Yeah. Right. Well, that's interesting. I think a lot of there is some squatting, but it's a bit not as active squatters these days because the authorities here are very, very, very violent. But there's been a number of interesting squats in Melbourne and Australia over the years, but not as famous as yours. So it's nice to meet
Aku
the spokesperson.
Aku was quite famous, yeah. Yeah. There's a few famous buildings. Like in Amsterdam, we have the building Frankrijk.
Yeah.
And then there's Arnhem. They have Hotel Bos. And in Wageningen, there's several complexes. Yeah,
from the 60s and 70s.
70s mainly, yeah.
Mainly 70s. Simpari, what was it like for you, honest, hard-working, tax-paying West Papuans who are now Dutch citizens dealing with these people, like Endy, the squatting? Did you have anything in common? How come your father was actually talking to them? What's going on? I mean, he sounds like an upstanding citizen to me.
Yes. Yes. I think, for me personally, I sense a sort of common rebellionship.
Rebellion.
Rebellion.
You
common with squads, that's my personal opinion.
Right, You're just sick and tired of working up the right channels and getting nowhere. What we
also,
say.
Yeah.
That's what we say.
That piece is my personal feeling and opinion about that.
Now, I understand. I mean, you weren't born in West Papua.
No.
You weren't born in your village in Biak. Did your parents ever go back to West Papua, and have you ever been back?
Yeah, both of my parents have been back together and separately. And me, myself, I've been back a few times.
Right, so you've met your extended family in Biak.
Absolutely, yes.
Right. Well, some of them were survivors of the Biak massacre in the 80s?
Not in my direct family, but I know a few.
You know
people
a few. So when was the last time you were in West Papua?
2022, so three years ago.
So, and the time before, when were you there?
Ooh. There was quite a time, 95.
So did you notice any difference between 95 and 22?
Actually, no.
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 And so is it a paradise or is it an Indonesian prison camp?
It's like an Indonesian prison camp in paradise.
An Indonesian prison camp in paradise. Yeah. That's the best description I've heard. So it could be paradise if there weren't Indonesian soldiers in every... Was it 200 or 300 meters?
The last time I was there, it was almost literally how you described it.
Yeah, because I understand there's one Indonesian soldier in West Papua for every adult male West Papua. That's over 250,000. And that I've been told on numerous occasions, there are roadblocks, checkpoints, every 10, 15, 20 kilometres with soldiers with bayonets and submachine guns.
I can't speak on the whole of Papua, but Biak, where I went, that's about it. Yeah, that's quite accurate.
How do people feel who are living there at the minute? How do they feel about this?
It's not spoken openly about it.
No, you get taken away if you spoke openly.
Yeah, but I could see by her manner, by their manner.
Right.
That they didn't like it.
Right.
It's like that, it looks rough.
Rough. Yeah. Can I steal your description? Paradise in an Indonesian prison camp.
Yeah.
It's the best description I've heard of West
Papua. It's the other way around. It's an Indonesian prison camp.
In paradise. Indonesian prison camp in paradise. Oh. I like that. I think that says it all. It says it all. An Indonesian prison camp in paradise. Now, when was the first time you put your eyes on this book?
I guess it was 5 years ago.
Five years ago.
The Dutch version.
The Dutch
2020.
Version. So what?
2020.
Did you just see it for the first time at the launch, or did your dad say, look, I've done this book, or is this a secret? Indies. Look, this is radio. Stop shaking your head. Tell us what you're thinking.
His dad and I decided we would launch it for the family.
Right.
On his birthday.
Which is when?
2020.
Yeah, but
5th of August, 2020.
2020, right.
And then later on in the same week was the open launch.
Right.
And because this is in the middle of the corona time, COVID time,
yes.
We couldn't have like huge gathering.
No, that's right, yeah.
So, but I happen to be a volunteer at a windmill, an actual Dutch windmill.
An actual Dutch windmill.
With wings and everything.
It all works, yeah.
And it has premises. So we decided we do it there.
Yep.
And it was little Papua because all of a sudden the temperature went up to 40 degrees.
Right.
We are surrounded by not just a windmill, but sheep and goats and pigs because they live there as well.
At the windmill?
Yes, at the premises of the windmill.
Okay, all right.
At the premises of the windmill to make it more Dutch.
There wasn't Don Quixote there also?
No.
No, right.
No donkey.
Okay.
No. But the first time Eddie's children saw the book was on their father's birthday.
Right.
The only person who saw it before that was Eddie's wife.
Right. Yep. And what did she think?
Oh, she was so proud. Right. The first few years, she hated the book. She would call while we were working.
Mm-hmm.
How much work can that be to write a book? What time are you coming home?
Oh, sounds a bit jealous.
No, he came home late again and again and again. Mm. And also...
Your mum didn't ask you to check to see what was going on, did she?
No. I didn't live at home anymore.
Lucky, yeah.
She knew he would always come home for dinner.
All right. So, so when did we contact you from the office regarding doing an English translation? When did Louise Byrne contact you?
Probably a month after we had the Papua, Pasar Papua.
Right.
Last year?
Last year. When David Bradbury was in Utrecht,
right.
He interviewed us, me and your dad.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, your father was not doing very well anymore. He couldn't really join the interview, but he did the yeses and the noes and laughing at the right moment. Very short interview about the book during a Papuan event in Utrecht,
right?
And he put it on YouTube. And he sent it to Louise.
Right. And are you happy with the English translation? Are you both happy with the English translation? Yes? No?
Yes.
Maybe?
I'm happy it is translated.
Into English.
Yes.
Right.
I'm not 100% happy because things get lost in translation.
They do. They've had a movie called Lost in Translation, haven't they?
No.
Wars start when people don't understand.
Yeah, true. But of course I'm happy. And for two reasons.
Yep.
The first reason, I promised Eddie.
Yes.
I promised him it would be translated.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are.
And the second reason?
The second reason is because I believe that the English version will make more people aware of the Papuan story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think this Eddie's story is very easy. It's not an easy story, but it's easy to read, and I believe you start liking that person while you're reading the book.
Yeah. It's what we describe as very accessible. You don't have to be a professor to understand the book. It's the book of an extraordinary man during an extraordinary time, which you've written beautifully.
Thank you.
Beautifully,
so much.
What it does is it retains memory, because when we die, like when your dad died a year ago. It's easy to forget. Within a generation, everything is forgotten unless it's put down. And even on the net, it's forgotten. It can just disappear overnight. So I'm very pleased that you came here. How did you feel on Sunday, Indy, when you came here, when you were welcomed by the West Papua community?
Totally, completely overwhelmed.
Yes.
And very, very lonely because I was supposed to be there together with somebody.
Yes.
And then the welcome was so overwhelming.
Yes.
It would have been so nice if we would have been there together.
Mm.
And then with Bridget to keep us on our feet.
Right.
You know, to keep moving and, you know, just do it.
Yeah, but Bridget was trying to keep Sampari alive.
Yeah, well, well done. Well done. She Bridget, did a great yeah. job.
Would you like
very
to come,
happy.
Would you like to come over here, Bridget? Yeah, come and share the microphone with me. Yeah. I did brush my teeth this morning, so you'll be all right.
Lick it with my hand.
Yeah, yeah. So how sick was Sampari when he got here?
Oh, he was very sick. He had fever, he was shaking, stomach aches, he was up all night making weird sounds. I was really worried that we had to call the doctor. But in the end, it all worked out. So.
Worked out, yeah, yeah. Look, we're very proud to have both of you here because what you're doing is promoting not only the West Papuan struggle, but you're humanising it by telling one story of one individual and their interaction and their life and their family and their culture. What you do is you make it accessible to people. People begin to understand on a one-to-one basis. It isn't some type of ideological mission or some armed struggle. It's really about a human being who had to leave, forced to flee his country with his wife. They were forced to leave their country because it was taken over by a colonial power. You know, so it's an extraordinary story, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, Sampari. Now, could you tell us again that Instagram, web page, Facebook, so people can get in touch with the music you're involved in?
Our band is called Oceanics. That's Oceanikz. If you look that up on the Instagram or YouTube or Spotify. Surely you'll find our music.
Right? Yeah, I'm going to ask an embarrassing question. Do you sing or do you strum? Or both?
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. And Indy, how involved are you in the squat? I know you're the spokesperson, but do you live there or you use the facilities?
Actually, I live in a house that was my squat.
Was your squat, right. Right, another squat.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a women's squat, three women.
Right,
and right. In the end, the owner was about to have us evicted, sent some strong guys. The strong guys felt embarrassed because we were three young women.
Right.
At that time.
Yes.
So they didn't come to beat us up. They decided to not do that. That would be embarrassing. We forced him to negotiate with us.
Right.
And actually the same story as the big squat.
Right.
We offered him to buy the land under the house, so not the house. Well, I still live there.
Right. Sampari, Indy, Bridget, thank you for coming to the studios. This program will be podcast by the very talented producer, Daryl. Now, Daryl, you want to wrap up?
Sure, Joe. You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guests Indy van Binsbergen and Sampari Kawa.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.